man stood there in the compound on top of the hill, silent now, lost to dreams and gazing over the landscape. He had just retold me how the colonial soldiers came to capture the town and his freedom. He stood there for a long while, recalling perhaps all that happened to him and those he had known since then until this day, in the waning years of the era these men had ushered in. If so, his vision of colonial history had certainly very little in common with the standard accounts one finds in textbooks about the period.
That's from the introduction to the book Being Colonized, The Cuba Experience in Rural Congo. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What was it like to be colonized by foreigners? What can be learned from the experiences of the Cuba people about racism, economic exploitation, indirect rule, Christian conversion, modernization, disease and healing, and transformations in gender relations? If we look at local news, customs, gossip, and even dreams, how does our notion of this time and place become far richer than in traditional textbooks? Joining us to explore colonial Congo is Jan Vansina, Professor Emeritus of History and Anthropology at the UW-Madison, and author of numerous books, including Living with Africa, Kingdoms of the Savannah, and most recently, Being Colonized, The Cuba Experience in Rural Congo, 1880 to 1960, published by UW Press in 2010.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
What made you decide to take this particular approach? Was there something in your personal experience in Africa over the years that made you think this would be the way to go about a history of colonialism here?
I took this approach way back as a result of a particular class of data for the Middle Ages, before I ever went to Africa. At that time, I was writing an MA on oral traditions in medieval Europe about deceased kings, and only those traditions that had been versified in Latin, medieval Latin. And it turned out that there was a whole world there that the sources did not mention. I mean, these oral accounts explained a great deal. But then, as it happened, by chance, I went into anthropology, was sent to Africa, and was supposed to do social anthropology, which I did, in this area, in the central Congo, in the middle of the Congo. And social anthropologists in those days were supposed to observe, not to believe anything people said. What people said was irrelevant. They had just to observe.
Why does that seem ironic?
But, you know, I'd been trained as an historian. And to historians, this just doesn't work. So I began to listen to people. And when I realized that people had oral traditions and the different ways in which they kept them and handed them over and what they consisted of and what the literary qualities were and all that, I began to realize that I had to do something more than just the ordinary oral tradition, the ordinary social anthropology. So I had at that time 2 years before me, and the institute for which I worked had money. Not lots of money, but money. So they wanted me to hire people, helpers, to assist with taking social statistics about all sorts of things. What I did was hire these helpers and set them to collect the histories of people, including their reminiscences of the colonial period itself, written down by these helpers. And the helpers did what they wanted. Well, to a large extent, they could pick out their topics and talk to whoever they wanted. So in fact, what I did create, I see this now, many years later, I created the equivalent of a newspaper. So there was the daily news. I collected dreams because I'd done some psychology. And a series of dreams tells you more about people's aspirations than anything they could say. And, you know, also all sorts of other cases. So to me, this thing came together at that time. And I didn't realize anything original about it. But this was the collective view in the late colonial period of these people, of what colonialism had been, as well as their pre-colonial history. And it included some stories that are very, very reminiscent of what we know in Europe or in the U.S., when fathers or grandfathers tell about their experiences in the war of such and such. You know, the style is the same, that the little things that you count on from the point of view of memory and recording are the same. So it was very vivid. And then I let this stand for many years. I did all sorts of other things with oral tradition and without oral tradition. But in the last 10 years, it became obvious that something had to be done. Why? Because the history of Congo had been reduced. Congo, after all, is a very large country. It's as large as the U.S. east of the Mississippi. So that history had been reduced recently to a story of atrocities. The atrocities committed under the regime of the first Belgian king, whose colony it was. Before it belonged to Belgium, it belonged to him. And then from there, straight to independence, and to the major turmoil that happened just after independence. So the image everywhere else was that Congo was a trouble spot, that its people had been eternal victims, they had been massacred by Leopold's agents, then they became independent and they began to massacre themselves. So this is not the history of the Congo. That was one. The other one was that even sympathetic people, even liberal authors or what have you, made the big mistake of treating Africans as victims. You know, victims and certainly to be sympathized with, but not as agents in their own right. And this is all in this book. It's trying to rectify that. It is trying to rectify a general image about colonies in general. Now, you might say, why would this do it? Well, as chance has it, this is in the middle of a very large colony, which itself is in the middle of Africa. And most of what is in this book can be paralleled by cases from elsewhere in Central Africa, in much Southern Africa, West Africa and the like. So it is much more representative in the end of a whole colonial system than you would imagine.
The colonizing of Africa, though, did that experience, if you can generalize, vary depending upon which country was doing the colonizing? I mean, we're talking about Belgium here, but of course France was there, Germany was in parts of Africa, England.
And Portugal, well, even Italy. But no, the point is that from certain point of views, from the point of view of the colonizers, there are big differences. From the point of view of the colonized, especially rural colonized, the differences are not all that big. The one colonizer will rely, say, on forced labor, that is, asking people to work so many hours a week for free. The other colonizer would simply require a tax that you could only earn by working so many hours a week. I mean, those are differences between them. There are differences towards the end of the colonial period, but not in the middle or in the beginning of it. And that is true for Africa. It's also true for Southeast Asia.
As you were trying to collect data and get helpers to work with you, I would think, now you're a white man with an accent from where?
Well, this is another point. I am from Antwerp, but I learned English on the street in London. So I have part of a French accent because of a grandmother of mine. So it's a weird accent.
The cosmopolitan speed.
Right.
But I was trying to picture how, you know, there you are in Congo, coming from a different culture, doing sort of social statistics and getting information. I would think you'd have to establish a relationship of trust in order to have any chance of getting accurate information.
Well, you're right. So what I had to do was, first, I was very young. I was 21 years old, barely, when I started this. And I came out of the Second World War, which means that, you know, I knew that you had to work your way through things. So I arrived. The language had never been recorded, had been recorded, but very badly. And nobody except the local people spoke it. No foreigners spoke it. So I started by learning the language, and not learn it in a major center, but as chance would have it, in a very, very small bush village, so that when I arrived in their major center, I could speak the language up to a point. That made me different from everybody else.
Sure.
As did my age.
And what was the language? Which language?
Bujong.
And are there unique features about it?
Oh, yes. It's a Bantu language like many others. But unlike others, it doesn't have final vowels. It works a great deal more with tone pitch, absolute pitch, than we would think. For instance, you know, bat means women, bat means people. And don't confuse the two. So, you know, this sort of thing. And foreigners did not easily see that it was a Bantu language. They thought it was a weird, weird thing, completely different. But in any case, that helped. And all the evidence, by the way, was collected in the people's own language, not in translation.
So before we get to more directly your experiences, if we can just back up a little bit historically and find out why the Belgians were in the Congo in the first place. What was it that attracted them to it?
The Belgians were not attracted to the Congo. That's the weirdest thing. In the 1880s, Belgium was the second industrial power in the world after Britain and on an equal level with the U.S. I mean, this sounds crazy, but that was the 1880s. At that time, its king, it has a constitutional king called Leopold II, and Leopold II wanted a colony. The Belgians didn't want the colony, but he thought that if you were an industrial power, you needed a colony, and he was going to bestow it on them. So by skillful diplomatic maneuvering, he managed to get the great powers to acknowledge, to grant him the leadership of a very large portion of Central Africa on the grounds, in the capacity, as his being the chief recognized of all the chiefs in the local area. I mean, as a diplomatic nonsense, nothing has ever been done better. But he got the main powers to agree. They wanted to keep the European balance of power in Africa. So this was too big for Britain, for France, for Germany. So, you know, let's let this king have it in his own capacity, provided that trade be free, you know, and so on and so forth. So he hired people, and it's very much like the UN today. You found Bulgarians and Turks as well as Belgians and Americans and so on. And then, because he was the king of Belgium, once he began to outsource and began to create companies, and the companies began to exploit the population, especially when rubber was in demand, an international outcry followed. Well, the international outcry was the first, probably historically, the first case in which mass media, this time led in Britain, resulted in having such an influence that they overturned the Leopoldian regime, and he was forced to turn it over to Belgium. And the other powers did recognize that. Belgium took over in 1908. They had an election about this. People were not necessarily convinced that this was good. They had an election, and the pro-colonial people won, but by less than 10%. So you cannot talk about, you know, Belgium having this huge desire to colonize. The 10% won. Belgium took over and immediately was faced with the necessity of reform. That is, of doing away with all these abuses, with this outsourcing to main companies and what have you. And that's how we became Belgium. That was their job.
And I know you said that in your book you spend quite a bit of time talking about the unknown parts of the Congo story, the fact that not everyone was a victim and it wasn't all massacres. But it is true, is it not, that the Congo was one of the worst places in Africa in terms of what happened to the people and the resources?
Well, it's the most exemplary one. I mean, worse things happened, in fact, in the neighboring colony, the French colony of Congo. But this was the exemplary one. There is a chapter in this book there are two chapters in this book that deal with this. One of them details exactly what is understood by these atrocities, exactly how much time they consumed, who they affected, who were the perpetrators in part and who were the non-perpetrators, because in every single case they opposed one African group to another as well as the European exploiters. So that's one. The other chapter deals with the demography. It's been claimed by Adam Hochschild in particular, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for it, that half of the population was destroyed over that regime, which is 20, 30 years maybe, and that run was over 10 million people. In fact, these statistics are only part of the truth and are not really true. And you have to show case by case how they did it, how this happens, that you get somebody in good faith and a whole movement in good faith claiming that half of the population disappeared when it didn't. The answer, as any demographer knows, is they counted deaths. They didn't count births. And, you're dealing with a balance of being born and dying, of immigrating and emigrating. So it is a much more complicated story. And, there's one chapter that deals with that.
We'll look more closely at the Congo and its experience as a colony when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jan Vansina, and we're talking about colonial Congo, in particular his work with the Kupa people. For those of us who are not familiar with the Congo and the many different peoples that are there, the countries that it borders and so on, can you take us there? Tell us what constitutes the Congo, and then sort of zooming in on this group that you studied, the Kupa people.
All right. The Congo is a very large country in the middle of Africa. It has 11 countries as neighbors around it. It's the heart of the continent. It is the area, most of the area, that is in the basin of the Congo River, which, like a dragon, starts in the southeast, has a huge bend in the north, and then a small mouth in the Atlantic. This area encompasses a great many different people that you can arrange in sections according to the main environments. As I said before, it's a very large country. So you have savanna environments in the south, which is open bush with lions and the like. Then you have tropical forest, the second biggest tropical forest in the world, in the middle. And those have not only chimpanzees, but bonobos, if you know these animals, who socially are the closest to people. And then you have in the north yet another savanna. And in the east you have volcanoes. The Kupa, being in the middle, fall in an area that is still tropical forests, but just near the savanna to the south. They form the kingdom of their own, the size of the state of New Jersey, more or less, by 1600. But when the colonial period began, they were found to be a kingdom. And the first Europeans who arrived there, the first Europeans were first the Portuguese and then some Germans, had a healthy respect for the area because this kingdom was supposed to be extremely powerful. It wasn't, but it was supposed to be. So that started off their relation. The very first explorers found what they thought was unadulterated Africa, no influence from anywhere else. This is how Africans were since the time of Adam and Eve. And this is where you find African art. They found great African art. The African art became so famous within a short time that the British Museum claimed that it was the best African art in the whole world.
And collected it then, I assume?
And it was collected by, of course, the British Museum got a large collection.
They put it right next to all that Greek stuff.
Would that be masks and carvings and
textiles?
This is the carvings and textiles. On textiles, they are still considered to be the most outstanding achievement in Africa, alongside with Coptic textiles from North Africa, simply because of the complexity of what goes in it. And dancing. It's local people realize this. But foreigners who have never been there, of course, don't know about Kupa dancing. Kupa dancing, in fact, is perhaps the most impressive of absolutely everything. They had, amongst other things, ballet dancing with 20 or 30 people involved and spectators, just as you would have in a ballet, and very complicated stories in it. One of these ballets was they performed for the Queen of Belgium when she visited. Now, it happens that the Queen of Belgium, 1928, Queen Elizabeth, was a person who was very familiar with ballet. She was a German princess before she became a Belgian queen. And she was overwhelmed. So she took pictures. And, you know, all that enhanced the reputation of these people. It enhanced it to the point that still under Leopold, when the atrocities began in this area and were reported in London, that was at the time that Leopold was going to give up and the Belgians were taking over. And this had to be quelled. But the Kubel had already been famous because of their art. And so people in London understood that, aha, here these famous artists are being persecuted for the grubby interests of rubber, you know, that sort of thing. And the Belgian government had to backtrack. So the Belgian government, ever since in Brussels, has used the Kubel as a sort of window on the colony. Our colony is a perfect colony. Look at the Kubel. Here they are working on their art, or they're doing this, or they're doing that, which meant that they had powerful protection against the local administration.
How did the Kubel or any of the other Congo people benefit from this arrangement? I mean, did, for example, the Belgians provide security against any kind of outside incursions?
No. They benefited. It's a very good question because you have to ask who benefited. As it happened, their government, the Kubel government, was incorporated into the Belgian system, and the Belgians helped them whenever there was unrest in the kingdom. But the benefits of this situation meant tribute and income. Tribute and income went to the court and the courtiers. The others, the ordinary people, paid taxes or did obligatory labor for various companies up to so many hours a month or a year for the whole duration of the period. So, yes, the court benefited. The king and his people, the people around him and his government benefited. All in all, to give you a number, something like over 1,000 people. The grandchildren of that 1,000 people are still better off today, you know, 50 years after independence, than others in that area. The people who suffered were rural villagers who had the demands made on them by the Belgian economic policy, as well as additional work by the king. They only accepted this king. This is a very interesting story. They accepted this king essentially because he protected them against some of the further things Belgians wanted, like recruits for the army. Military service was 7 years there. So recruits for the army, the kind of crops that they were supposed to grow. You know, you may have obligatory labor, but it depends what is asked of you. In some cases, it is things that you would do anyway. In other cases, it's very different. You would not do.
Did the people of the Congo have any use, for example, for rubber themselves, or were they just forced to?
Well, you see, the Kuba knew about rubber. They used it for drums. They did not know that their rubber was supposed to be the best in the whole of Africa, which is another irony, so that the rubber trade would last the longest there, long after it finished everywhere else. And all rubber came from Malaysia and went to Firestone or something like that. Well, Firestone comes from Liberia. Still, the Kubel rubber was still being exploited because of its quality. So, yes, they knew about rubber. They were traders. They were very good at trading.
And ivory?
They were trading in ivory, they were trading in rubber, they were also trading in slaves. They were buying slaves for themselves from people who wanted other things in complicated patterns.
Up to about, what, 1850 or so?
Oh, no.
Not after that.
The Kubel entered the slave trade in 1870, and
they
quit it
going?
A little after 1900. You know, it's another idea to think that European powers put an end to the slave trade. Belgium was not strong enough. I mean, the independent Leopold II did not have the means to suppress the slave trade, especially not in the beginning. So what actually happened was that the slave trade extended in the first years of the colony, besides the Belgian penetration, I mean, the penetration by Leopold's agents. And so the heyday of the Kubel as traders in slaves lies between 1870 and 1905.
Where were the slaves going?
The slaves, okay, this all begins in Angola. The Angolan slave trade is centuries old. many centuries. So slaves would come to the harbor, would be brought to the harbors in Angola, where they were picked up by big companies that bought them, moved them over to Brazil, Carolinas, you know, whatever, and then brought sugar, essentially, right, and other products to Europe.
Part of that rum triangle.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But these big companies were not pursuing slaves in the interior of Africa. That was other companies, local ones, with Portuguese or people who were descendants from half Portuguese and half Africans. And they would organize caravans and go and buy slaves in the interior. I'm simplifying a bit, but that's how it went usually. So by the mid-1800s, these caravans were beginning to go very far. By that time, the slave trade internationally had been stopped. I mean, no slaves were exported, even from Portugal or from Angola, after 1840, roughly. So what they wanted were, you know, legitimate trade, cotton, coffee, you know, the tropical products. But the people in Angola whose business it was to trade in slaves just continued. They went further. They bought slaves. They brought them to the center of Angola. They sold them there. And those people who were growing crops used those slaves as labor.
So it was kind of an indirect.
Yes, yeah, so you know, it's an indirect slavery. Yeah. You know, even on the coast of West Africa, men. Slave trade continued for a while, but the slaves were absorbed near the coast where they went to work in plantations.
I keep thinking about Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Mm-hmm. To what extent does his allegory about going into the heart of Congo and discovering such corruption have to do with this area?
Look, Joseph Conrad is very reliable. We know when he went. We know we can fit every one of his descriptions to particular actual cases. What is, of course, special to him is his psychological analysis of this, whether the psychological analysis holds up completely as he has it. I don't believe so. I think that there is some artistic license pushing it a little bit further. But it is true that you did find people that claimed that they were bringing civilization. Unfortunately, the cost was all these dead people. And, you know, you had to collect the rubber because you needed the money to civilize people. So that, yes. No, that is perfectly all right. He didn't go to the Cuba area specifically. He went up the main river. But many of the events that he deals with on the main river have parallels, later parallels in the Cuba area as well.
So were there any kind of you know, uprisings against either the Belgians or their resident king in these late years of the 19th century?
There were uprisings against in the Cuba area, only against the king. Individual villagers would reject the king and tell him, we don't want to do with you anymore. We want to be the people of this missionary or that trader or something else. But it wouldn't last. I mean, it would be a year or two, and then they would come back to the king because the villagers realized that, in fact, they had more benefit than harm from kingship. Europeans, of course, interpreted all of this as saying, oh, these are divine kings.
Yes.
Divine kingship is an invention from Europe that is fitted unto various African situations. Of course, the court wasn't going to say, no, we are not divine kings. The court was saying, yes, leave it to us. You know, we are the customer. We know how the customs work and so on. So you should not come in and tell us that we cannot do this or we cannot do that.
So there were no great efforts on the part of the Belgians to indoctrinate the Cuba or anyone else into Belgian culture, religion, that kind of thing?
All right. Belgium is special. It's not France and it's not England as we had before. There is no Belgian culture. It simply doesn't exist.
Well, what about that beer?
You know, Belgium is a federation, by the way.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's
okay?
Right.
Okay. Yes. So it's either Flemish culture or it's Walloon French, yeah. French culture. At the time, of course, there was one Belgium. There was one official Belgian culture, which was the Francophone one. But most of the missionaries in Congo, and there were more missionaries than anything else, came from the Flemish side and assiduously preached that there was no Belgian culture. That, in fact, culture is tied to language and that Africans have their own culture. So Belgium is unique. I mean, that colony is unique in that you can find school books from the colonial times, from the 40s and 50s, in local languages that say colonization is unjust. We should have our own state, and so on and so forth. And the central Belgian government didn't catch it because they didn't know these languages. Mm-hmm. Only the missionaries knew them.
But wasn't, I would think, any time, though, that you have people from one culture mm-hmm. coming into another, that there is going to be this interchange, there will be
the
effect. How do you start seeing some of the impact of Belgian culture, such as it is, on the people there?
Well, you see the impact pretty quickly. What the Belgians were trying to do, or the missionaries were trying to do, was to create copies of themselves in the Africans. You know, what they succeeded in doing was creating a common Congolese culture, a common Congolese sense of identity and culture.
Among all these, what, 450 different
amongst
peoples.
All these 450 ethnic groups, there were only about, at independence, 14 million. Now there are 50 million in the 50s. And it is that sense, plus the rule of dictator after independence, that made the Congolese into one nation. I mean, Congo is always on the point of breaking apart, even today. And I have to remind you, there has been a great African war that has killed 6 million people in the last 15 years in Congo. It's just ended about 3 or 4 years ago, and most Americans, or most people anywhere else, do not realize that there are more victims there than anywhere else after the Second World War.
This is based on ethnic rather
than
national lines? No,
this is an international war. It's a war pitting African countries against each other, starting from Libya in the north to Namibia in the south. That's from the north, from the Mediterranean to Southwest Africa, and from East Africa all the way. Every state in Central Africa has been involved in this.
Is it a boundary dispute, or what is
No,
the...
it's a very complicated story. You know part of it, which you have heard of, that triggered it. The trigger to it was what was called the Rwandan genocide. Mm-hmm. The genocide in Rwanda is itself, that was my previous book, by the way, because I've worked there too. The genocide triggered this. The genocide itself is a very complicated thing to understand. How it came about. You got people divided in two factions that were ready to exterminate each other. That's a story apart. But because after the genocide, the invading group from Uganda had won, the group we know as Tutsi, that's not all the Tutsi, but that part of the Tutsi had won, they tried to pursue their enemies in Congo. At the same time, Congo was ruled by a dictator called Mobutu, who was old, who had developed cancer, prostate cancer, was no longer very much in control. But nobody realized this until the Rwandans went to Congo. They invaded Congo to pursue other Rwandans who had taken refuge there, and Ugandans did the same. So Uganda and Rwanda began, they invaded Congo, they overran the country. And other countries, all these neighbors of Congo were interested. The most important one amongst them was Angola. Angola had, by then, by the 1990s, an army that was a modern army. I mean, with air force, artillery, tanks, you know, the whole works. And in Angola, there was a civil war, and it was being fought on a high level. It was part of the Cold War, and when the Cold War ended, the civil war still continued. But that civil war was involved in this invasion of Rwanda and Uganda that altered the balance there. So to make the story short, 2 years later in 1998, the war began again. In 1996, the Rwandans had picked somebody called Kabila who overthrew Mobutu. Mobutu was replaced by this Kabila. And then this Kabila didn't want the Rwandan control anymore. All right, so he sends the Rwanda packing. Rwanda invades again with Uganda. This time Rwanda had also a modern army. But the Angolans, who had won their civil war, I mean the Angolan faction that had won the civil war, didn't agree, sided with the Congolese government. And between 98 And about 2005, there was continuous fighting. And as I said, you know, from Libya, which was involved in the north, Libya, Chad, yes, Sudan, right. They were all involved, to the south. This lasted for many years before finally a peace agreement could be agreed on in South Africa. That peace agreement, you know, has never really worked perfectly well, but it stopped the major fighting. The fighting has not stopped near Uganda and Rwanda, where there's still some fighting as late as 6 months ago, but now that is dying down too. And the only reason the Congo held together is this sense that we are Congolese. And that comes from, you know,
the Belgians.
From the Belgians and Mobutu. They're the Belgian missionaries and the Belgian officials who tried to create surrogate images of themselves, created instead a pan-Congolese feeling that we are Congolese, these are our experiences, this is our identity.
Is that not similar to what, for example, the English did in India, with giving them a sense of an Indian identity as opposed to however many small states before the British
colonized?
Up
to a point, although you might, in the Indian case, you might claim that the Indian identity was already existing at the Mughal courts before. In this case, it is Kinshasa. It is the city of Kinshasa and specifically the music of Kinshasa that set forth the values that everybody else accepted.
The music.
Or Congolese music is still the leading music in all of Africa.
We're going to get some more details about the Kuba people in Congo when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jan van Siemen, and we're looking at the Congo, and in particular a group of people in the Congo with whom our guest is familiar by dint of collecting stories from them, and that includes dreams, and then using that as a large basis for the story of the colonial experience in the Congo. These people, the Kuba, as long as you have mentioned dreams as an approach to history, Jan, give us some examples of how you brought dreams into this experience of the Kuba people.
Well, the Kuba are interested in dreams. Unlike people in this culture, dreams are something you talk about. They are not the kind of thing like I dreamt, you would say something weird from time to time. No, people talk regularly about their dreams. They thought that dreams gave them pointers to what would happen in the future. They did not think of dreams in connections with ancestors because they don't believe in ancestors. That's one thing the Kuba have.
Don't believe no ancestors. In ancestors.
How can you not believe in ancestors?
Because they believe in nature spirits and they believe that people are reborn. You know, so somebody dies, the next life is in an animal, say a leopard. The leopard dies and then you're reborn as a child, usually in the second generation. What makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But with this, the dreams give them an idea as to what will happen to them, and they are good omens or they are bad omens. That's what they think. In fact, of course, what you do when you start collecting dreams on a fairly large scale, something different emerges. Now, what I did do was simply I got somebody, one person, dream person, to go around and record dreams for a given group that we had set up, divided by gender and by age, so it would be well-balanced, you know. And I thought, I don't really know what's going to happen, but I do know, at that time, the main psychoanalytical theories were, you know, Freudian or Jungian or whatever, and what they had to say about dreams. And, of course, these supposed to be recurring in other cultures or not was a question they had never raised. At that, basically, nobody had raised that. It was as if everybody in the whole world has the same dreams and that you have to interpret it in the same way. Well, the Kuba did not interpret their dreams in that way. In any case, when I had assembled all of them, two things stood out. One was that they were extremely good in telling you what people's aspirations were. That was one. That, you know, somebody would dream, I go to the big city and I become a mechanic. And the person would dream that several times. Now, obviously, that's important. Somebody else would dream that their king had a quarrel with the European administrative officer, and the king won, you know, or that the king had done this or that, and the sun set in his yard. And so they went, his dream actually was that they went out to talk to people whom they called the savages, further down, you know, way further down, to explain how the sun had set in the courtyard of their king. You know, you put that in the context of the year and the dates, and you figure out which you have, you know, who the people are. And you know everything about their families, because one of the things you do in a setting like that is take genealogies, yes, but also see how people are connected to each other residentially. In fact, I did it for a capital of over 2,000 people, but I did the main of it for all the Kuba villages in the whole country. So we had an idea, you know, it's exactly where people stand and what these dreams mean. So that was one thing.
What about nightmares?
Aspirations.
What about nightmares?
Oh, well, that's another one. You see, the other thing is that they told you a lot about what people do not talk about, which is witchcraft and their fears. Now, to know what people fear, you have to look at the charms and get into what charms you make against what. And you have to pay attention to nightmarish dreams. And some people dreamt that they were witches. Not just that they were bewitched, but that they themselves were witches. Or, in a famous example, a friend of an old woman said, hey, come along, you know, we are witches, we are going to attack so-and-so in your family. And the old woman said, oh, no, in a dream, I don't really want to, you know. This happened in 1956. It was recorded in 1956. In 1959, 1960, there was an outbreak in the country around the time of independence, which, by the way, for many people in the Congo, looked like the end of the world. They did not know what was going to happen. So there was an outbreak of anti-witchcraft, of anti-witches, you know, witchcraft ordeals and witch burnings, literally witch burnings. Some 500 cases occurred in this area. The ordeal is one where you give people a poison and either they are poisoned or they reject the poison. If they reject the poison, they are not witches.
That's the same logic that, you know, that was used in this country in the 17th
sure.
century.
I mean, you know.
We tie rocks to you, and if you drown, it's a no-win situation.
It's exactly that.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, guess what? One of the cases in 1960 was the woman whose dream I had recorded in 1956, which means that for 4 years after that, this still festered. Other people still thought she must be a witch. And, you know, she herself and some others thought she was not a witch. So for social tensions, dreams are also excellent. Now, when I look at these dreams 50 years after the event, or more than 50 years after the event, you know, you can be asked, what were the aspirations of young Congolese going towards independence? Well, my answer is, here are the dreams. I don't have to guess what they said. I don't have to go by what they might have said at the time, which is always colored by other things. You get a sort of evidence that you can put aside other data and make you really sure that this is what people were after.
In the press release about your book, it also says you use gossip.
Yes,
explain what gossip is and how that
seems.
Well,
gossip is very simple. You take a community that has no newspaper and no radio, you know. You tell one person, now you write down the news of the day. What is new? What is people are talking about? And gossip is what people are talking about day by day. And so you get the equivalent of a newspaper. But it's a local newspaper, so it will tell you that so-and-so is suspected of having made charms to bewitch so-and-so, that so-and-so has been caught trying to steal a chicken, that so-and-so has fallen ill, has been to the hospital, I mean, has been to the local clinic, but that they couldn't do anything for her. They sent her to the major hospital in town 300 miles away. She died before she got there. I mean, you can see what, I don't know how you call it in English, but in French you would call this fait divers, the little local news. And that is an incredible source of information about what local people and what they're interested in and what they do.
And how does that relate to the colonial experience? What kind of gossip
The colonial experience is supposed to be a total experience. So it's supposed to be reflected in everything. And the images that you have in textbooks about colonial periods are of heavy oppression. Now, what this gossip thing tells us is, yes, the colonial presence is known if you know about it. You know it is, after all, the colonial power that should have built hospitals and dispensaries and not forced people to travel 300 miles or 250 miles when they are ill and they die. You know, there is something about the colonial period in there. You can also see the reaction, say, to colonial schools and gossip about what's happening at school, what happened after school, how you celebrate the end of the school year. Do you do it with traditional ceremonies? No, you do it with something modern. And so you gossip about what's the latest song that they have in Kinshasa, you know, stuff like that. Indirectly, you can see the government everywhere in it. You see the government most specifically when the gossip deals with, this is the agronomist who is supposed to supervise the obligatory work that we are doing. He was there and yesterday, and he will be there tomorrow. You know, so people beware, he's coming, and so on.
How would those dreams and the gossip change during independence?
Well, after independence, as I said, independence itself is a very chaotic time. You know, 3 months before independence, that is just barely 60, 70 days before, you find the kings writing to the Belgian governor, for our next administrative officer, we want this Belgian and not that Belgian, as if independence wasn't going to happen. But the Belgian governor themselves was not very clear as what was going to happen. I mean, it's an incredibly complex period. So what happened after independence? Well, the content of dreams changes. It's no longer, you know, I want to be a mechanic. It becomes more like I want to become a priest, which is a very good occupation, or I want to go into the military. I want to become an officer, which before independence is something people didn't think about.
So now they're thinking, what, maybe more along institutional lines?
Well, about careers that were close to them and are now open. Of course, I have not been collecting dreams recently, but I would expect a great deal more dreams about violence of all sorts than in the days of the colonial power.
Well, you have a conclusion called The Experience of Being Colonized. What sort of conclusions, based on the Kuba people, do you reach about colonialization?
You see, the Kuba people, or some people amongst the group that I studied, were asked by sociologists 15 years after independence, and a local sociologist, that is somebody who knew the language well, did a PhD about this for an Austrian university. I don't know what the Austrians made of it. But basically, he asked them, amongst other things, what they thought of the colonial period. And most of the answers were, oh, this was a nice period. It was a very good period. It was a quiet period. People worked and they were paid their salaries, which is not true after independence, and so on and so forth. So people thought that the colonial period, the people who were questioned, was very good on the whole. Yes, there were some drawbacks, but no, I mean, you know, there was morality at that time. And the people didn't go around killing people or stealing or what have you, supposedly. So the sociologist himself, you know, abandoned neutrality to say, no, these people, you know, it's just, you know, the bad times of today that make them think that the colonial period was good, it must be. But essentially, they remembered the colonial period specifically as a bad thing for very specific things, like the obligatory labor is something they resented. And even 15 years and even 50 years later, people still remember that. They don't want it. But they did like other parts of it. What they did not understand was that the standard of living in Congo began to fall from the year after independence continually. It's now lower than it has ever been. And why was that? In a nutshell, because with independence, obligatory labor fell away. There was no more. So the underpinning of the whole system was that forced labor. And everybody benefited from it. For instance, if you built roads or maintained roads, trade would flow over the roads and this and that would happen. But it was still forced labor. And so people still don't understand. I mean, you really have to explain it in detail to Congolese today, that and Scuba today, that the fact that the standard of living fell was a consequence of the colonialism. Was a consequence because it's based on forced labor. And if there had been a system where development, quote-unquote, had occurred without forced labor, that would not have happened. I mean, it might have continued or it would be different. So then they realize, yes, that this is the case. But they all realize, and to give you an example, one village, about 1,000 people, that, you know, that appears in the literature from 1891 all the way up to now. Colonial period, the end of the colonial period, there is no water, there is no electricity, there is no school, there's nothing. And the thriving market that there had been in the pre-colonial days had gone. The standard of nutrition had fallen. The houses were about three-quarters of the size the old houses had been. That's the colonial period. Now, we look at it in 2008. You may have heard about Ebola.
Yes, the virus. Mm-hmm.
The virus. Ebola virus has attacked this place twice. The second time, lots of people died, and it was not clear which virus it was because there were three viruses at once. I mean, Ebola and two others that are not much better. The medical service had just collapsed. So, obviously, these people are still not better today than they were in the 1880s. And, of course, they know this.
It's been a very interesting and maybe even counterintuitive look at the colonial experience in the Congo with our guest, Jan van Cina, who has an interesting approach to history, including dreams and gossip. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, our guest, Sean Peters, will fill us in regarding the phenomenon of faith healing. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4. It's University of the Air. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.